History is full of amazing getaways. From a former crime boss who escaped the mafia...
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
...to the Beaconsfield miner who survived 2 weeks trapped underground.
A remarkable tale of survival against incredible odds.
So this week, we celebrate them. Pete, Matt and Kimber's Great Escapes Week on Mix 94.5.
Some incredible stories that we came across this week through our Great Escapes Week. Brian Robson being one of them. He's the bloke who got mailed in a crate from Melbourne to the UK.
It just sounds so amazing every time we say it.
And got lost along the way as well. Lived to tell the tale. Dr. Richard Harris, one of the two Australian men that were part of the dive team for the Thai cave rescue.
It's incredible stuff.
Brant Webb and Todd Russell. And who could forget the image of them punching the air as they came out of the Beaconsfield mine. Brant Webb joins us on the show now. Good morning to you, mate.
Hey, thanks very much, Pete.
Brant, this is such an incredible story. I mean, you and Todd trapped for 14 days and it was 5 days in before you had communicated with rescuers and that they knew you were still alive. Tell us about that first 5 days. What kind of conversations were you and Todd having during that time? And no doubt you would have been feeling very vulnerable.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot said. At the time, we were more lying to each other because they were blowing us up. Remember, they set about 5 rounds of explosives off. So at the time, we weren't doing too well. We were just sort of trying to keep positivity, really. That was about the only thing we had going for us, but we actually thought we were going to die, so it was a pretty somber moment.
Oh, I'm sure, mate. And it's a pleasure to be speaking to you. I mean, we were, like everyone, I was absolutely glued to the TV for 2 weeks with this story and the elation that we all felt as a community when you guys came out. What was the emotion, probably close to elation, when you first realised that you had been found at the very least?
I was a smoker at the time and, mate, I was lighting up in darts like all get out. Well, they're coming for us. We're saved, you know.
I hope Todd didn't mind the secondhand smoke.
Oh, mate, he ended up smoking. I got him smoking. He's still smoking.
Oh, no.
Brant, when you did hear those voices for the first time, you know, obviously there is that feeling of elation. But then, you know, day five and then day six, you hear the voices and then day six turns into seven, which turns into eight, nine, 10 and onwards towards 14. Was it long before elation started to move towards, oh, my God, even though they found us, I don't know how we're going to go here.
Yeah, it was about 20 minutes, mate. And they said, look, we don't know how we're going to get you out. And I said to Todd, I said, mate, this ain't America. We're buggered. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, in America, they have a fire. They send in 50 firefighters. If 40 come out, they're happy. I said, in Australia, we get one rescuer die. They just go, can it? And I'm like, gosh, we are gone here.
Wow.
We're never going to get out. We're going to be rats in a cage, you know.
And, mate.
At the time, I could have been the best shoplifter in Australia because I had no fingerprints. And because I was trying to dig my way out, you know, I've gone through all the gloves. The gloves have got holes in them, so you just start on the hands. But it's sort of surreal now that I'm here, you know, talking to you guys. But at the time, I mean, we actually lied through our teeth at each other flat out to say everything was great and positive and everything else. But in the back of your mind, we thought, we're dead. We're never going to get out of here.
Wow. That time when you were about to walk out, I mean, how were you physically? You know, we've been talking to people about being in situations where they've escaped and, you know, now their legs don't work. Their bodies are not cooperating in the way they should.
Yeah. Well, they made us wash our hair so we couldn't take any gold out. But in the end of it, we had two guys under our wings. I don't know if you've ever looked at the photos, but when we actually come out, there was two guys there underneath our wings to catch us when we fell, you know. Like we had no adductor muscles.
Yeah. Oh, Brant.
Brant, mate, when you did walk out, there's a bit of info here that I don't remember. I was quite young when this happened, but I do remember that image of you guys walking out and fist pumping the air. And it says here, the miners hugged family and friends before climbing into two ambulances, laughing and joking. Before going, they removed their identity tags from the wall outside the elevator, a standard safety measure when miners finish a shift. Do you remember doing that?
No, we orchestrated that because that was a message to our brothers, our mining brothers, that, you know, in the fact that we got out and you go to work and you come out at the end of the day. And in mining, that's a pretty big deal. We're pretty lucky here. We don't have too many deaths, but if you count up the deaths we've had in Australia, I do believe that there's probably one a year for every year we've been mining.
Yeah, wow.
You know, like we've lost, you know, 100 and something guys in one day.
Yeah.
And Brent, how's your life changed since that point? You hear people say we went through this terrible situation and now I'm living each day as if it's my last or whatever. What's been one of the big takeouts for you?
Well, 4 years ago, I actually had a workplace incident that dragged me straight back down and gave me PTSD and anxiety and never worked for 3 years.
Right.
So all the, so you can do really well. I did really well for 10 years. And then all of a sudden, this minor little incident, you know, and I mean, that was my life. It was gone, like, just like that. And I always, you know, like I was one of the skeptics, you know, like this mental health thing, you know, if you've never had it, of course you're going to doubt it. But once you've had it, you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. It's the most crap thing I've ever had happen to me. That it's uncontrollable. You get your name called 100 times a day. You've got wind noise through your ears all the time. It's bad enough we've got a ringing in the ears from when they blew us up five times. But, you know, like that was the turning point in my life. Before that, I even got cigarettes put into every police car and ambulance in Tasmania.
Yeah, right.
Because we were smokers, right? And they wouldn't send me smokes. Yeah. And I went off my head.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what a position to give up smoking, you know?
Yeah not really the right time.
No. It was a big deal for us, you know, and we got laws changed in Tasmania, right? Because we had no mining law, no directors were accountable for death, coroner's thing was all different to the mainland, and we got all that changed. Like, by me surviving, was I actually, like every survivor has been through a major traumatic incident, you come out worse, but you can't sort of get back to where you were. I'm pretty lucky. I've got so many great people around me to steer me through those tough times, you know. I was one of the lucky ones, but not everyone's as lucky as I am, and we've got great people around them. So my life after the accident, if you put it in really short terms, I live for today, but I think about tomorrow.
Oh, that's extraordinary. Yeah, because I suppose being on this side of it, you do sort of look back on it and go, you must have a great life being someone who survived something like that. And then to hear what really goes on, it's eye-opening, mate. It certainly is. It's not just a great escape from that moment, but by the sounds of things, you know, something you're holding on to for the rest of your life and still looking for it. So it's great to hear that you've come out at the other end doing quite well.
It's great to hear men talking about it too, because that's the thing. You did go through a very vulnerable and very difficult stage, and it's, you know, I don't know if it's expected of you to come out and be really stoic or whatever, but that sort of stuff changes your entire life.
We appreciate your time this morning, Brant. Good on you. Thank you so much for joining us, mate, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks for letting me share it, guys.
Mr. Franzese, good morning.
How are you guys?
Yeah, we're great.
Well, I hope.
We are. Very well. Lovely to have you on the line.
Yes, indeed. And far out. I mean, I'm reading here, former New York mob boss, and the first thing that comes to mind is, how does anybody become a former? I thought you never get a chance to leave it.
Well, technically you don't. I mean, you can't just say, you know, I'm leaving and I resign and I retire. It's not how it goes. But it wasn't an easy path that I took. You know, in being able to walk away from that life, not cooperate, not enter a witness protection program, and, you know, live publicly. But, you know, I always say there's two reasons for that. Number one, I knew the life extremely well, so I knew what I needed to do to protect myself. And number two, you know, I'm a person of faith, and I think there's certainly God had a different plan for my life.
I bet.
I was in business to a great degree. I had legitimate and illegal enterprises on the street. And fortunately, I had success in both. As far as what I did on the street, I was fortunate and I knew how to use that life to benefit me in business. And, you know, that's a skill that you got to develop in that life. And I was able to do that. I went on to make a very significant amount of money. And, you know, I think the skills that I developed on the street have certainly helped me, you know, since I've left that life.
Michael, it's fascinating stuff. And I guess, you know, the gangster life, filmmakers love it. Makers of television love it. All the actors love playing tough guys and whatnot. And you get the feeling that the person who's the most ruthless is the one that wins. But what's the character trait of someone that is successful within the life, as you call it, that might surprise us, that isn't just about being the meanest dude?
You know, honestly, I'm glad you asked that. I don't think I've ever been asked that before, you know, with regard to the person that's the most ruthless is the one that succeeds. And if you look at the history of our life, the person that's the most ruthless normally meets his demise at some point in time, because you just can't act that way in that life for a real long period of time. It's not going to work. In that life, you have to be more diplomatic. You have to gain friends, not gain enemies. Mm. And And the way you gain friends, it's very simple. If you're successful in business and you're spreading the money around, people don't want you to go away. And, you know, I was fortunate. People were upset with me when I took a plea and went to prison because the money that was flowing through me had stopped at that point. And so they were upset with me for that reason, among other things. But, you know, when you're making money for people, you got a lot of friends.
Yeah,
and that preserves your life. When you're arguing with everybody all the time, and when people believe you to be a threat to them, well, they want to eliminate you.
Mm.
Michael, you mentioned, you know, when the money is flowing, you're making friends and they'd be very upset if anything happened to you. You also mentioned earlier on that you did things to protect yourself. Does that go hand in hand, or what were some of the other things that you did to protect yourself through that time?
Well, you know, when I walked away from the life, I had to know what I was doing because people were upset with me. You can't just renounce your oath, you know, and say, hey, I quit. So, you know, unfortunately, guys and ladies, I'm sorry. You know, one of the horrors of that life is if you make a mistake or you're in trouble, you may not know about it. Your best friend walks you into a room, makes you nice and comfortable, and you don't walk out again.
Mm.
And in the 20 plus years I spent in that life, obviously I've seen that happen.
Mm.
And so for me, I knew what I was going to do. And I said, well, they're not going to walk me into a room. They're going to have to work to get me. And so I moved across country. I moved from New York to California. I could have never made it in New York. There's too many guys there and I'm too well known. So I move out to California. I changed my whole lifestyle, meaning I didn't walk my dog every morning at 7 o'clock. I didn't go to the same, restaurant every Tuesday night. I didn't create patterns for myself. I didn't go to places where I knew I would be, you know, well known and be, you know, tagged. And I just outlasted everybody. I was very disciplined in that because you have to be disciplined.
Michael, do you feel that the mob life cost you genuine connections and relationships? And if so, does that bring regret?
Yes. I mean, look, you know, there were times in that life that I made good relationships. I had good friends. Unfortunately, they're all gone now. And I knew when I walked away, I'd be leaving that behind. But, you know, I had to make a choice. And I knew if I stayed in that life, I wouldn't survive. At some point in time, you know, I'd probably end up in prison for a lengthy period of time. I mean, I did 8 years. That was enough. You know, longevity is not part of that life.
Well, Michael, you say longevity isn't a big part of the life, but your father belies that fact, does he not?
Yeah, my dad, he died at 103, but he did 40 years in prison.
Wow.
So when you're in prison, you're not a threat to anybody. Sure. You're not active on the street. What kind of life is that?
Yeah.
I tell everybody this. You wouldn't want my dad's life the last 50 years of his life.
No.
That's for sure.
Michael, you know, it does say here that that you operated your father's legal rackets during his imprisonment. So essentially you were elevated to captain when it all sort of went down and you had to take over. Obviously, at that time, you're old enough to get an understanding of what's going on. But as a kid, did you know, or what age did you really know and get an understanding that this was the family business?
Well, very early on, because my dad was such a high profile figure, you know, from the time I was a kid. So he was always under scrutiny. We had law enforcement around us all the time. He was being, you know, surveilled quite a bit. You know, I knew it early on from the time I was a kid in elementary.
Yeah. Michael, you know, you are the exception to the rule in that you escaped this life that, as we've talked about, no one escapes, no one gets out. You don't just get to leave. And now you're working with the youth and trying to prevent them from following a life of crime and addiction. Is it hard to get that message across to them when in many ways you were a success?
Well, you know, it wasn't hard because, you know, I was more successful in walking away from the life. And I think a lot of these kids, they don't want to be in that life. They just don't know how to get out of it. And to let them see, you know, the height that I reached and the fact that I was able to make that transition has a real impact. And, you know, it's like anything else. When you've been there and done that and you're talking out of experience and they look at you as being a part of the mafia, Cosa Nostra, they look at that as the biggest gang in the world.
Mm.
And basically it is. So if you can walk away from that life and succeed, you know, it matters a lot to them.
Michael, you talked about your faith. And one thing I'm just genuinely interested, again, you know, most of my research is films like The Godfather. So I know that's not a documentary, but that idea of particularly Catholicism within these families, that idea of faith and illegality, indeed, you know, murder, all kinds of crime and harm to people, how do those two things marry within the life?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question too. And the thing is, in reality, they don't match. Mm. But when you come into that life, you believe it's a life of honor.
Mm.
You're told that, you know, look, we've made a decision that if we violate the rules, we could pay for it with our lives. If our friend violates the rule, he's going to pay for it. We may be called upon to do that.
Yes.
So we're saying, hey, you know, the playing field is level. We understand what we're getting involved in. It's a respect and an honor issue. So we justify it in that way. And of course, it really doesn't add up. But that's how we justify it.
Sure.
Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure having a chat to you. Thank you for your honesty.
All right. Appreciate it. Take care now.
Pete, Matt and Kimber's Great Escapes Week on Mix 94.5.
This is one of the most extraordinary stories that we've ever heard about. And what better way to tell it than the bloke who was actually airmailed in a wooden box, believe it or not. Brian Robson, good morning to you live from the UK.
Good morning to you all. Good morning.
Brian, you find yourself as a young man in Australia. You think this is going to be the trip of a lifetime. But when you're here, you go, sod this. I want to go home, but I can't afford it. Your first attempt to go back to the UK was to stow away on a ship to Britain, but you got busted and you did 10 days in jail. And so the next idea, to lock yourself in a crate and ship yourself there, what made you actually do this?
Well, it shows how bad Melbourne was in the 1960s, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
No, actually, we weren't drunk, any of us, because we were kids or teens, and I don't think any of us drank, actually. We went to an exhibition and seen an advert there, or a booth there, for Pickford's Removals. And it said, we can move anything anywhere. And I said to my friends, who all wanted to go home, I said, well, perhaps they could move us. Then we went home, or they went home, I went home, and I couldn't sleep all night. I was awake, and I thought, crates, 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 Pickfords, Pickfords, Pickfords. There must be some way of doing this. And I was awake all night. By the following morning, I was quite convinced I could do it, but of course, I needed Qantas to help. So I went to Qantas offices in Melbourne, made inquiries as to whether I could ship a crate COD, paperwork required, size of the crate, all that sort of thing, and then went back and told my friends.
And so basically that's what you did, wow. Right? You got in a crate you with a suitcase, and the crate, you had to sit cross-legged, and your plan was...
Not cross-legged, my legs in my chest.
Beg your pardon, quite right, curled up, yes. And your plan was, and Qantas told you that this could happen, is that within 36 hours... you could be delivered back to the UK, but not you, whatever was in the crate.
That's right. And we invented some mainframe computer parts as being in the crate. And actually, I think it was nearer 48 hours, to be honest, with Qantas. So we went ahead and we planned it and we bought the crate, and things were progressing quite well, really, I suppose.
Brian, things were progressing quite well. How did they end up going in the end?
Badly. And sometimes now part of it thanks to Qantas, because they put me on the wrong flight. They promised me that they would put me on a particular flight at a particular time on a particular day. And so I flew in the crate from Melbourne up to Sydney, was left on the run on the tarmac there for 22 hours. And I thought, this can't be, the Qantas flight's gone, you know. And
I'll just stop you there, Brian, because weren't you upside down for those 22 hours?
I was indeed.
Oh,
I was actually sitting, I was standing on my head and neck and passing in and out of consciousness.
Oh.
Don't trust airport workers.
No.
You didn't have one of those little signs on the outside that says this way up with the arrow pointing?
It was all over it. It was this side up, fragile, handle with care. They were all there and they took no notice of any of them.
Now, Brian, we believe you went into the crate with your suitcase and you also took a hammer with you as well. So should you need to break out, or when you want to get out of the crate, that's how you were going to do it. But you didn't break yourself out of the crate, did you?
No, I didn't have a chance. In actual fact, instead of going on the Qantas flight, they put me on a Pan-American flight.
Mm.
And we covered just about every runway, every dirt track or whatever, and landed in Los Angeles.
Wow. Yeah.
Long walk home from there, believe me.
So 4 days later, you were pulled out at presumably Los Angeles Airport. I mean, people thought you were dead, right? You almost had rigor mortis.
That's right. I couldn't move. I couldn't move a muscle, actually. My muscles had all seized up. My joints had all seized up. I couldn't speak. The only thing I could do was move my eyes around. And so they knew I wasn't dead, but to all intents and purposes, I was. And they rushed me to Los Angeles Central Receiving Hospital and started to restore the body balance.
Brian, I've got questions about, you know, what that moment must have been like when they broke you out. But I want to go back a quick moment. When they were initially putting you into the crate, your mates, and hammering it away, you were obviously expecting that you were going to be in that thing for, you know, 36, 48 hours. So as far as things like going to the toilet and eating, what had you sorted out for yourself in there?
Oh, I'd planned all that. We at first considered installing a flush toilet, but we couldn't. and so consequently, I went on a diet 3 days before and with taking laxatives and stuff like that to clear my system out. And then for the other end, I actually had an empty pint bottle and a pint bottle of water.
Pint of water, that's all you had?
Yeah. In fact, I don't remember drinking too much of the water because I think, you know, it didn't take long before I didn't know what I was doing, whether I was coming or going or anything. It was a very, very short time.
Brian, you know, we're giggling about it with you now because, I mean, it's an incredible story and obviously you survived to tell the tale and write a book about it. But honestly, you know, how far in were you before you thought, oh my God, this is an absolutely shocking idea and I'm probably going to die in this crate?
I was elated, actually, part of the way, because when I flew from Melbourne to Sydney, I thought, well, you know, I can live. I can live in the air. I know I can fly, which I didn't know whether I could or not.
Yes.
And so when I got to Melbourne, I was quite elated. How long did it take me to sort of worry about it? Well, to be honest, the pain was there almost immediately. But when I was upside down at Sydney Airport, I did at one time think, you know, you've got to give this up. This is not going to work. And then I thought, would I rather live in Melbourne, Australia, or would I rather stay in the crate and see what happens? Oh, and the crate won. Quite
God, the Australian Tourism Board is really looking forward to this story coming out, I tell you.
They've employed me, H.
Brian, when they actually found you, you were on the tarmac in LA. How did you do? Would you alert them that you were in danger? Were you hitting the walls of the crate? What happened?
No. I wouldn't have hit the walls. Well, actually, I thought I was in London, to be honest with you. And mind you, I couldn't move. I could hardly move. But my idea was to get out of the crate and to walk home, you see, as if nothing had happened.
then, hello, Mum.
And then nobody would have ever known, and I wouldn't have got this job with the Tourist Authority of Australia. But I had a torch in there as well, and the torch was about 6 inches from my nose, hanging on a nail. So anyway, I got this torch, and at the same time as I managed to get it, I turned it on and dropped it. Yeah, it hit the bottom of the crate, and the beam was shining out of one of the sort of slats in the wood, you know.
And someone saw it.
So, yeah, two airport workers were walking past, and I heard them say, there's a light in that crate. They came walking over, messed around with the paperwork for a bit. One of them bent down on his knees, looked through the notch hole. I think about 6 days later, something like that. I was in hospital for that time. And then they... quite rightly so, put me on a Boeing 707 and flew me all the way to London.
So, Brian, were you thinking when you got home, were you going to write a letter to the boys who nailed you in the crate and say, hey, thanks, I made it, this is how it went down, or how were you going to let them know that you survived?
Well, that was the original plan. When I got home, I would actually send them a letter because in those days, I mean, the cost of telephone calls and stuff like that, you know, I would send them a letter. But of course, in the meantime, I was discovered in Los Angeles and that hit the headlines. And so they knew before I got home that I'd been stopped. But when I did get home, I did maybe 2 weeks later send a letter. I've actually located one of the people that helped.
Oh, you're joking.
Honestly, 56 years later, the only problem is that they want to remain
Anonymous.
Oh, really?
Anonymous, okay. Exactly. And so we have had two conversations, only one of them, the other one I don't know where. And he's got seven grandkids and whatever. And we've been chatting about the past and having a great time on the internet.
Lovely.
That's incredible.
What a story.
Brian, wow. What a story indeed. And just how good is it that you're here alive to tell the tale? The Crate Escape is your book. The book is available online from austinmacaulaypublishers.com. We thank you so much for your time this morning, mate. Really nice talking to you.
It's great. It's great to be back in Australia with you, Blues.
Always welcome, buddy.
Good on you, mate. Thank you
very much.
You can find out more about this person's particular podcast, Real Risk, at realriskpodcast.com. It's fascinating listening. His name is Dr. Richard Harris. He is one of the 14 cave divers who rescued the Wild Boars soccer team back in 2018 in an operation we all now know famously as the Thai Cave Rescue. He's been kind enough to give us his time this morning. Good morning to you, Dr. Richard.
Good morning, guys.
Dr. Richard, one of the most fascinating things about this story for me is that you've reflected on it, saying when you were first contacted and said, can you come and help? They said, could you try and sedate these boys and bring them out through the cave? And that your answer was absolutely not.
Yeah, it was actually a friend of ours, Rick Stanton, who was one of the British cave divers who first went over there. Two of those guys went there to help find the kids, which they eventually did. And it was Rick who I was chatting to one morning when I was back here in Adelaide who suggested that sedation idea. And to me, the idea was completely preposterous. I mean, the idea of rendering someone unconscious and pushing them underwater and expect them to come out the other end 3 hours later and still be alive just seemed outrageous. So I was not very keen on that idea.
And Dr. Harris, tell us about the dangers involved in cave diving and this particular dive, because as we know, a highly trained Royal Thai Navy SEAL lost his life in this rescue. What happened in that situation? What are the dangers?
Yeah, that's true. And that was very sad that that guy drowned in the cave. But I think the important distinction to make is that cave diving should be and generally is extremely safe, but it's imperative that you're appropriately trained and equipped and in the right mindset and so forth. And unfortunately, history is littered with a lot of very capable and expert divers who have wandered into caves but haven't had that specific training and they've lost their lives. Mm. But, you know, it's like anything. If you follow the rules and you're well-trained, it's very safe.
Okay.
Craig Challen, who also was part of this, and you were both jointly awarded the 2019 Australian of the Year as a result of that rescue. I've seen him tell this story at a lunch that I was lucky enough to go to a couple of years back. And he talks about specifically what you guys did to these young boys to get them out of that cave. Can you recount some of the process for us here?
Yeah, well, my good mate Craig, who's your local boy on the ground there in WA, he and I were over there and we had to work out, you know, the best way to help the British guys get these kids out of the cave. And so Craig, with his veterinary anaesthesia experience, and myself with my human anaesthesia experience, I guess had to help cobble this plan together to work out how to sedate the kids and bring them out. So it was about 2.5 kilometres the kids had to come out, and of that, well over a kilometre was completely underwater. And the cave was not like the caves we would normally choose to dive in. It was an actively flooding dry cave, which made it quite hazardous in terms of the diving conditions, zero visibility, very tightly restrictive in places, and of course the flow to contend with as well. So first of all, the British divers did an extraordinary job to even get through there and lay a rope that we could follow and find the kids in the first place. I mean, that was an extraordinarily courageous and skilled bit of diving that they did. So it was a lot easier for us just to follow this rope through to where the boys were. But then, you know, this 3-hour trip with the kids, we had to work out how best to do it. And the biggest concern was that they would panic if we just dived them out without them being asleep or sedated. And I can assure you, we looked at every possible option to avoid doing what we did. But in the end, the only thing we could come up with was to have them unconscious and have a mask that would seal all the way around their face to protect their airway, because obviously they wouldn't be able to hold anything in their mouth. So I had zero, I felt there was zero chance that this could work without them drowning or succumbing to some other complication from the anaesthetic.
Well, I suppose you had been briefed on the logistics of the rescue and your background experience is one thing, but when you actually saw the kids, was that feeling different?
Well, it was all pretty hypothetical till I actually could lay eyes on the kids and see the environment in which they were, you know, living for these past 12 days or so by the time we got there. And actually seeing the kids gave me a bit more positive outlook because they actually were incredibly courageous, very upbeat. They looked physically quite well. I mean, they'd lost weight, obviously, without any food at all for 9 days. But they were in reasonable shape. And most importantly, they were optimistic about, you know, what we were planning. So they were amazing to work with.
Optimistic, you say? Not even scared? Like, you would have had to have talked them through the process.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, we were lucky enough to go back to Thailand the following year and get to talk to these kids because I had all these burning questions like, you know, what did they think of us? What did they think of this harebrained scheme? And they replied with a very simple statement, and that was, we trusted you, which was actually pretty heartbreaking to hear because, you know, we had zero confidence that they were going to come out alive. We thought we were going to start the day with these beautiful young kids, you know, happy and smiley, and then by the end of the day we'd be pulling their bodies out of the cave.
Oh, well, Dr. Harris, I'm looking at a photo of you. You do have a trustworthy face, so I will give you that. And I noticed that, of course, it was a story that captured the world's imagination, and of course Hollywood has optioned it, and I believe Ron Howard is looking to make a film called 13 Lives. Any thoughts on who you'd like to play you?
Well, that's out of my hands because I've just heard that Joel Edgerton is playing my role.
Oh, so he's a good piece of casting.
Yeah, I think he's a good-looking fella and, you know, a bit skinnier and younger than me, so I'm pretty happy with that.
I'd be happy with that, yeah.
Missed your shot, Matty. Yeah. Almost. All right. Dr. Richard, this has been a pleasure. Mm. Thank you so much for giving us your time this morning. We really appreciate it. You can find out more about your podcast, Real Risk, at realriskpodcast.com. Take care, mate. All the best.
Thank you. Good to chat.
Pete, Matt and Kimber's Great Escapes Week on Mix 94.5.
We are live at Fremantle Prison and we're joined now by Courtney, who's one of the tour guides here this morning. Hello.
Hi.
Courtney, when we talk Great Escapes in WA, we quite often hear the name Moondyne Joe. Who is this guy?
Moondyne Joe is definitely our OG escapologist at Fremantle Prison. He was a convict sent over to Western Australia for basically stealing the ingredients of a good toasted sandwich. He was caught, you know, with some cheese and some bread and some mutton and bacon. He was sent over here for 10 years.
Gosh.
That was his crutch. Yeah.
Wow.
He's mutton and bacon and cheese. I mean, he had the right idea for a good toast.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a man after our own hearts.
He's just opened a cafe in Claremont.
And so how did he get out?
Well, so he actually got a ticket of leave when he arrived here in 1853, which meant he was actually free to roam around Western Australia. And it was because he was caught stealing a horse that they threw him in the 2J lockup in the early 1860s. But he escaped from there. He picked the lock and disappeared. And that was the beginning of a long history of getting out of places where he was currently incarcerated.
Uh-huh. Including here at Fremantle Prison. Okay. So how did he get out?
He managed to escape here twice. The first time he was in solitary confinement, which was a very hard place to escape from, and he managed to somehow get out of his cell and escape over the walls with a pair of leg irons attached to his ankles.
Wow. Whoa.
So, we're driving in here this morning. Anybody who's driven past the Fremantle Prison knows how high the walls are. Like getting over the top and then dropping down in leg irons and stuff, he didn't break his legs, didn't just got away.
Yeah, he managed to, disappear not far from here and strike off his irons. And then he went back into the Avon Valley, like near the 2J area, which was where he was most familiar. But unfortunately, he was caught, brought back here. And that second time, they made a cell for him that was definitely meant to be inescapable.
Yes, we've just seen that cell and they're all small cells, but this is incredible. I mean, it's just, did he ever get out of that one?
Well, a challenge was set to him. So the man who was running the prison, George Hampton, basically gave Moondyne Joe a challenge when they threw him in here, into that cell. And the cell, just to describe it, it has, you know, Jarrah sleepers on the floor. So it's reinforced. It's got three sets of bars on the windows, hundreds and hundreds of nails knocked into it. And so he was left in there. But because he became quite ill, because he was left in basically the dark on bread and water rations, it was on doctor's orders that he was given a task outside of his cell to do every day, which was to break rocks in the main parade ground just behind the superintendent's yard. And from that, he was always watched by sentries, and those piles of rocks that he was breaking every day were meant to be removed daily, except that they weren't after a little while, and the pile of rocks became taller and taller and taller until one afternoon Moondyne Joe realised that from the sentry's position he couldn't see Moondyne Joe behind that pile of rocks. And so instead of breaking the rocks, he used his pickaxe to make a hole in the perimeter wall.
And wow. Got out again.
You kind of, you know, the thing is, you're so impressed, you almost want to go, all right, off you go.
Oh, and it gets better because he made a mannequin so that, you know, he took off his convict shirt and convict's pants, and he used his pickaxe with a little piece of umbrella wire to kind of make what looked like a person on the other side of the rock wall. Oh. And so when he disappeared, he was disappearing in his underpants, basically, into the streets of Fremantle.
Wow. Oh, which around here wouldn't be that abnormal anyway. And was he caught again?
Well, not for a long time. Ah. He was a skilled and able bushman, so he could melt into the bush and he didn't have to rely on, you know, stealing in settlements to survive. But it was only because he decided to break into the Horton's Vineyard, the wine cellar in the Swan Valley, several years later, that he finally had his undoing.
Oh, good Cabernet Sauvignon has been the downfall of many of us.
And perfect for the toasted Sanger, damn so he really knows.
Courtney, just briefly tell us how things are coming back to life here at Fremantle Prison post-COVID. Because, I mean, as we've mentioned earlier this morning, and Maddie too, I mean, I've lived here my entire life here in Perth, and I suppose you don't tour your own backyard. I'm guilty that a lot of people are. So I've never done a Fremantle Prison tour before. How are you guys bringing things back together here?
Well, yeah, last year was a pretty interesting year for tourism and we definitely felt it. But we've been really grateful for people in Perth rediscovering their own town. And so, you know, the tours that we offer, we're really trying to let the people of Perth know that these, you know, they're really interesting tours and you'll find out aspects of Fremantle and Perth and stories that perhaps you've never heard about.
Mm. Yeah, I think people might think you're just walking around the cells and seeing, but there's so much more going on. There's a lot of stories. We've just seen a couple of cells this morning that you just know have epic stories behind them. So there's a lot going on.
Courtney, thanks for having us here and thanks for chatting to us as
well. My pleasure.